Hello? Hello, hey. What's up?
You guys got microphones?
Yeah.
Microphones.
Good morning.
Is everybody hurting?
Slightly.
Yeah, we wondered about the 10 a.m. paddle on the first day. All right. My name is Lindsay Simon. I'm a UX web developer at Google. And this is the panel on filching design. And I'll pass it on. I'm going to talk about the coder's experience when it comes to filching.
And my name is Luke Rabluski. I'm a senior principal of product ideation and design over at Yahoo. And I want to thank you guys all for trekking over here from God knows where. I know this is a big convention center. I'm going to be talking kind of about the user experience side of filching design.
Hi, my name is Skip Beatty. I'm a user interface engineer at Apple. And I'm going to be talking about the kind of legal and ethical implications of filching.
All right. So for starters, this awesome background here on my slides comes directly from Google's Presently product. I would never have been able to design something quite so cool. And though you can't see it, there are some really pretty white flowers on the bottom, too. So, oh well. All right, so filch, defined as to take as booty. And I thought that was an awesome definition because that's what we're going to talk about, how filching design can, you know, be something where it turns into misrepresentation, but always where it's very much a practical thing. And of course, the idea that we're playing, you know, that it's a game of electronic cops and robbers, that you could have this awesome controller, which I've used, to decide guilt and innocence would be really, really handy. But this doesn't exist. So, quick show of hands. Have you ever done something, put something online that you've either found inadvertently or somebody's copied because you meant for them to? Yeah, pretty good. We're getting stuff out there. That's good. All right. So, have you found something online that you found particularly useful and it solved a problem and you borrowed it? Yes. This is the culture of web development. And, you know, it's part of the internet. This gets into, you know, every facet of what makes it interesting, right? So, Jeffrey Zeldman has, you know, a pretty good quote that I like here to talk, say, the minute people stop borrowing your stuff, that's when you should be concerned. Just, you know, this is sort of, I can relate to this. If you're putting things out there and no one's using it, then maybe what you're putting out there isn't that useful. And so this is kind of a practical consideration. And of course, it would not be complete to have Cameron and Picasso doing the debate over, you know, good artist copy, great artist steal. So, you know, taking something and actually innovating with it is sometimes more important than simply making something the first time in a rough form, or what you might call creation. It's a fine line. So, you know, in the web development world, you have a couple different ways of filching, right? You can view source and copy stuff out of the presentation later. You have browser code, CSS, you know, maybe images, which are a little more obvious, right? You might have filching at an API level, where CakePHP is in many ways a write of Ruby on Rails in the PHP language. And so, minus active record, it is a, you know, it's an API rewrite. Content scraping, I've done this, taken a terms of service and readjusted it because I didn't want to hire a lawyer for $250 an hour to write something that no one's going to read. So, you know, it happens. Interaction flow, you use something on a site that you find really useful. You're like, man, they nailed it. They got something that just feels right. And maybe it's just like the sign-up process, right? It's some piece of the puzzle that makes sense, so you port that into your site because it's handy and it felt good. So that's sort of a user experience issue. And so filching can be great. You know, you're a weekend warrior. You're doing something. You've got an idea. You want to make it exist. You want to share this with people, right? You, odds are you don't have a research team, you don't have a visual design team, you know, you're not a corporation. So going out and filching from what you like and what you find out there is a good way to get that done. And, you know, or you find code that almost does what you want, right? And you just can tweak it and it will do, you know, just that. And you need a nav bar on your site. This is a great example, right? I know I've been told this at Starz. We need to think of something really cool for the nav bar. No, you don't. You need to make something that works so that people can get around your site. They can find links. You know, this is what's important. And this is tantamount. Don't confuse people. You don't need a circular navigation bar for people to get on your site.
But I think when we were talking about this earlier, the thing that I found really striking, though, is that, you know, nobody would ever suggest, you know, not exploring ideas for a product or for, you know, at a product at a corporation or a product even at a startup. But I mean, if your idea is, hey, I want to put together a you know, I had an idea about 2 weekends ago for a website reviewing playgrounds, because, you know, I have two kids and we go to the playground all the time and we try to explore different parts of the city. And I knew that it was something that I would never spend more than a couple of days on, because time's pretty limited. So, I mean, I would never want to try and reinvent the wheel on navigation, or like I'd probably, my first thought is, well, you know, go find a review site that does something similar, try to copy some of the ideas and the concepts from it, and maybe even try and, you know, get it done as quickly as possible. And you would never want to spend like 3 days iterating on navigation ideas for a little weekend project.
Right.
Unless your site is all about ways of navigation.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
In which case you might.
Right. Definitely. No. There's context here. It has to do with what you're building. So, in this case, we were building a security appliance, and you know, this did not need a complex navigation.
So you use the tag cloud to navigate it, right?
Totally. You know, denial of service. So, you know, a couple reasons why filching might be really bad or it sucks, you know. I think Luke's got a good example from Jeremy Zawadny's blog. This whole issue of emulation versus plagiarism comes up. You know, it's your reputation when you do this. You know, that's what it comes down to. There's a whole bunch of legal considerations, but in a lot of ways, it's what your peers will think of you. And, you know, you might do something totally stupid and forget context and make something that other people find unuseful. So that's kind of an overview of the, you know, what we're going to talk about today. And I'm going to talk about specifically the coder's experience, you know, writing code. How does this come down to, you know, engineering and programming for websites? I became a programmer largely because of two things. One, my friend Matt Williams, who gave me the Perl book, and I just thought it was funny. And I read the GNU Manifesto, and I was sold. This idea that, you know, we weren't going to just keep doing the same thing over and over again, that sharing was really tantamount to what made programming a socially valuable thing, that really resonated with me, and it still does. And that's the idea. I mean, it is part of the GPL is you take this stuff and do whatever you want to with it, right? But you're going to include the code and enable other people to do the same thing. That's the principle. And I think that's, you know, pretty important. So, and then you have things like, you know, recent, like the extreme programming movement or XP. You know, it says that design, the process of design, it's going to evolve as you do a project. You know, start your coding, get little things done right away. Don't try to, you know, architect the entire system before you've got something to think about, something to play with a little bit. You know, do the simplest thing to solve a bug instead of, you know, solving 10 bugs at once in one change. So these are kind of, you know, this is the culture of programming at some level, and this plays into this idea of why you might do filching. This is an awesome slide, which presently killed my animated GIF, but man, I had an animated GIF of this that was so cool. But this is really the programmer's experience, you know, learning things a lot of times. You know, you have IntelliSense, you write some code, you try to compile it, you find errors, you know, you Google it. You try some version of an answer, right? You go try it again. Or in my case, it's refresh in the browser, right? You're just doing this. This is an iterative thing. Sometimes you find the answer, you know, and you're like, oh, wow, that did fix it. And sometimes it doesn't. So in some ways, this is, you know, a kind of filtering. But this is the process of learning. And learning how to minimize this loop is, in a lot of ways, learning how to become a better developer. So it takes practice. You're going to practice filtering. There was a study that CNET did. They interviewed like 3,000 programmers just to see, you know, are you taking code? And you know, the classic example for me is the utility JavaScript library that's got like 15 functions, you know. They're like must-haves. They're not in the libraries maybe, and they're just really exemplary to me. So I always have that thing, and I may or may not use it, but, you know, it's not, I didn't write the code. It's code I've gathered and collected as sort of tried and true things. And so technically, when I gathered it and I was working for an employer, you know, I was doing this on their dime. Is this my code? Is this their code? Is this where I got its code? You know, it's confusing, right? And if it made it into their product, you know, with proper attribution even, is it, you know, can I take it still and use it? It's all questionable. So they came up with this definition for something like substantial code, right? This is like search and seizure law. What is substantial? Right? How do you know what's substantial? Is it the API? Is it architecture? Is it, you know, function and method names? Is it something that just makes it easier, a shortcut? Is it anything derivative? So now we're going to play Filcher Fair. And I have to point out here that both my awesome uppercasing and my slide deck and the notion of Filcher Fair come from Luke, because I filched his slides when he sent them to me.
My lawyers have been contacted.
So the idea is here, I'm going to show a couple of examples where the one on your right is technically after the one on the left. And so you're just going to yell, filch or fair, as loud as you can and as passionately as you feel. If you don't have a strong feeling, don't yell so loud. But if you have a really strong feeling, you need to yell. And, you know, this is the court of public opinion here, and this is where it matters. It's reputation. So Django as a derivative of Rails. All right. CakePHP is a derivative of Rails. I use CakePHP, but I agree, it's filch. Rails and Smalltalk. All right. jQuery and Prototype. So it's not the method names, right? It's not the dollar sign that makes this stuff. Dollar sign sucks. I mean, but it's in both of these, right? I mean, so it's not that simple. And maybe there is, but what's the substantial difference? It's tricky, right?
Well, there's convention, and then there's, you know, then there's infringement. You know, there's stealing someone's code, and then there's just using conventions that other people use.
Yep. But I mean, if you have a method that does exactly the same thing in both libraries, you know.
Yeah, but if it's implemented differently, then.
Right. So that brings me to the next side. So in theory, you have developers doing the same thing. In a perfect world, in some way to me, you have all these web frameworks, right? And you can actually port from one to another with some kind of abstraction layer. I don't know what it would look like, but something, you know, something like a SQL, AutoDB for frameworks, and you could just port, because they're all implementing the same API. And so in theory, you've got, you know, all these choices now. But you know the great thing about standards, right? This is the old gem. Now there's so many to choose from. There isn't a standard. They're all doing it a little bit differently, and it doesn't work the same. And what do you get then? Yep. You get the Frankenstein. You get the rip, you know, the thing that ripped it off, but not quite. Now, this is a pretty funny example. This is not a human being. This is a mask you can purchase and wear. This is Boris Karloff. Which one is real? Welcome to Austin, people. And this is not a pipe. So how do you know when you've created a monster? And this is an important thing for a coder to know. When should you, you know, you've borrowed a little bit, you got going, and now you should stop. Right, you shouldn't be using this anymore. I think if you've edited it, you know, somewhat meaningfully more than three times, you're probably in the, you know, you're into the realm of trouble. Or you cringe at the thought of doing it again, or you start, you know, error debugging and just taking the errors and casually putting them in the trash because you can't deal with them. You can't upgrade some part of this base thing anymore because the piece that you wrote now is, you know, special, and you know how it works, and nobody else can ever figure it out. You're in trouble. That's the monster, right? So how might you avoid this? How might you triage the kind of damage I'm talking about? So attribution, not only is it good perhaps just so that you don't try to take credit for it, but it's actually really handy. You go into code and find URLs in the comments. This is, You should do this. If you ever put something in your code, stick the URL where you got it, not just the attribution that's sitting there, so somebody can find it, right? Give the author feedback, file bugs, write blog posts. In other words, don't be evil. Share this stuff and be transparent about what you're doing. And so at the bottom, I have like a little proposal for something around this. In JavaScript and CSS, you find a lot of times that the typical way to do attribution is in these gigantic comment blocks, right? And so you're supposed to leave that there if you're supposed to borrow it, or if you choose to borrow it. And I would just say, listen, if you're going to write code and share it, come up with a better mechanism, because why should your users have to suffer like downloading, you know, a K of comments every time? We need something like the GPL for, you know, languages that are parsed in the browser this way. Well, minification breaks this a lot.
Some of the open source licenses permit just having a link.
Definitely,
To the full license that's hosted on a site somewhere else.
Right. But, you know, you see the copyright and leave this thing in here. Like, don't do that. So, and components are, you know, this is one of the things I think programmers fantasize, that they can build these websites with components and widgets that now code is also design, and you end up with these just stylishly devoid websites that are all widget based and they all talk, but it's just, it's got no flair, it's got nothing. So yeah, you can share this code, but keep in mind, and if you want to start putting something new into it, have fun learning the guts of this, you know, monster that's living down there that you borrowed. So I have a couple examples, but I'm going to go ahead and pass on now and see if we have time, and I'll come back to it. I've done some interesting filtering. I'll show one real quick. So I did a site, Dishola, and it's a food review site. And I started thinking, oh, it's kind of like Dig. It's sort of like what Skip was talking about. It's sort of a weekend warrior website, and you know, you have some things in common. And you know, there's still a few pieces here that you can definitely tell. You know, I wanted to implement this thing, but you can see down here, like, this is very much Dig-like. So I leave it with you. Filch or fair?
Fair. Oh, actually, I got a mic.
Oh, yes.
I'm good. I'm not going to filch your mic.
Thanks.
Okay.
Thanks, bro.
You are welcome. Okay, so for my filch or fair, I'm actually going to make you guys scream a little bit louder, and I hope that's okay with you. Let me do a quick little turn-off mirroring thing and go from there. So, as I mentioned at the beginning, I'm going to be a little bit more focused about the user experience side of the coin here and just start talking about some of the stuff that's out there. So, Yahoo basically has a front page, right? I work at Yahoo. This is the way most people come to yahoo.com. That's kind of a portal thing. It's got news. It's got this little personal assistant, search, logo, access to our navigation for what we provide. Another homepage that's out there is also AOL. You know, they also have like kind of a search area. They've got that personal assistant. They got some way to kind of go through here, get some news. And so, I don't know, I'll just kind of leave it to you guys. Filch or fair? So, in all fairness, webstrategist.com did a little bit more of a detailed analysis. And if you look at the sections of the page that are divided against identity, navigation, content, search, and advertising, there's, you know, there's some variation here. So, anybody want to change their vote? No? Okay. So, you know, I'm up here with Lindsay. He works at Google. Google, quite a long time ago, launched a search product, right? It's their search UI is pretty iconic. A few years later, Yahoo also launched a search product, and you know, we got into it. It was recently redesigned. But kind of both Yahoo Search and Google Search both have this front page, so. Fair. Huh? All right, that's the kind of, I hear like three people.
So.
Okay, I'm going to call that half and half.
You're saying, what you're saying is Google has a copyright on white space.
Yes, they have copyright. That's how you make it googly, I think is what they call it. Okay, so continuing with this example, a while back, Yahoo put together a upgrade promo for Internet Explorer, Internet Explorer 7, and you know, Google also put together a promotional page for Internet Explorer 7. You know, both things were basically designed to get people to kind of quickly download the particular product, and they've both been optimized with very unique features for Yahoo and for Google. But I'm not an expert on this stuff, so any thoughts? Well, I can't hear. Okay, so some people are calling for it. Other people wanted to dive a little bit deeper. And, you know, in this particular case, somebody did a detailed analysis and found artifacting. So, I don't know. Does that change your vote? Now, I'm going to take us down a significant rat hole. So, this came out. It was blogged by Jeremy Zawadny. And then it was also blogged by Matt Cutts on the Google side. So, in Matt Cutts' blog, he sort of said, yeah, hey, you know, maybe there's some similarities between the Yahoo and the Google IE page, but man, there's a bunch of similarities between how Yahoo all of a sudden is doing their sponsored ads and how Google was doing them. In fact, you know, there's a lot of similarity with some of this stuff. But I thought what got actually more interesting in the comments on Matt's blog. So he posted this article, and then there was a whole bunch of things discussed underneath it. And one of the things that people called out was, hey, the blog the design for your blog is actually a WordPress theme created by this person or this entity called Beckery. And when you look at this theme that this person released, there is a clause in there that says, hey, please provide attribution for the theme, right? So you see down in the footer, designed by Beckery and weblogs.us. Well, it turns out on Matt's blog, which looks kind of similar, there's no attribution. So we're kind of going down the rat hole here. And I propose to you, I mean, filch or fair?
Fair, but he should have attributed.
Okay. This guy's got a really, really strong opinion. Fair, but he should have attributed. So that's the way it goes. And another interesting discussion that kind of came up in the comments on Matt's blog was, well, what about this whole notion of sponsored search ads in the beginning? Isn't this an idea that Google got from Overture? So Overture made sponsored ads. I mean, yeah, Google made them blue. This is not me speaking. It's the comments on the blog, right? So the actual idea of these things, is that filch or fair? Fair?
It depends on if it's patented.
Depends on if it's patented, says Skip. He's doing the legal section later, so he's already chiming in, right? But the important thing is there's actually a number of different levels here. There's the full page design. There's the content mix you're putting on your application. There's the overall layout. There's things like color selection. And then when we got down to the whole notion of sponsored search ads, it's the concept. It's the idea. So this kind of got interesting to me, and I said, okay, well, given there's all these different levels by which you can reappropriate or reuse or share things, what are the different levels that you can actually start thinking about this in the user experience? And so 8 years ago, I had a website that looked like this. Thank God it's been changed. But I happened upon a site that was selling a car, and it just struck me as a little bit familiar. And so there's just some similarities between the color, layout, and structure, but I'm not sure. I got a panel of experts here. What do you guys think? Okay, clear filter. So now let's take this even a bit further.
Did you ever get any contact from them? Did they ever thank you?
I found them in my referrer logs. Actually, I found like four or five of these over the years. But here's another example. So this is a blog that I've run for like 4 years or so, sadly due for a redesign. But it's a blog about interaction design and interfaces. There's another blog out there about interaction design and interfaces that came out a bit later called UI Garden. And in the comments on this site, somebody pointed out that there were some similarities between these two things. So the general imagery, the general layout, logo on a transparent background, dotted lines underneath the tagline design. So now we're getting a bit more granular. Filch or fair?
Fair.
Fair. Okay, this one's fair. Now, I love my next example because I saw Jared in the back of the room. And I was trying to go even more granular. So I have this now. This is my site right now. There's a particular set of colors on here. And I'm speaking at a conference called Web App Summit that Jared Spool is putting on. And I said, what's going on here? So I just looked at the different color sets. And I thought to myself, maybe, you know, there's something here. Maybe I'm just a design nerd. So, again, you guys are my expert panel.
Fair.
Fair. Okay. So, but go, Jared. So, basically, the interesting thing about it is, you know, one of these examples was a full-on site redesign, right, where people, all they did was just swap out the text. Another one was there. You could make an argument that there's similarities in layout or styling or treatment of type. The other one is just flat-out only colors. So there's lots of ways to, quote-unquote, filch a user interface. And Lindsay mentioned a little bit before about if you were trying to develop something really quick, you might take a look at an existing example and proliferate it and kind of try and make use of it. So I'm going to offer some counter arguments about why you might not want to do that. So let's say I'm tasked with, I'm going to make a site for building out a family tree online, right? So it's going to be an application where I'm going to allow people to create their own family tree. I might find something online like Genes Reunited, where the first step in creating a Genes Reunited is just registration form, right? Well, and from this, I might get, hey, you know, like maybe I just really need a form to get people going on their family tree, and maybe they should just fill out, you know, marital status, year of birth, where they're born, and that way I can just get some information about them, and I can use that to kick off creating a family tree. Well, by doing so and just grabbing this thing really quickly and easily because it was fast development, I might miss out on a more appropriate opportunity. So this is a site called Genie, which there's really no quote-unquote form or sign-up process by which you start creating a family tree. You just jump right in there, fill in your name, click Start My Tree. All of a sudden, you're filling in your mom and your dad, and you're going through the process, right? So with this approach, these guys have gotten 5 million profiles in 5 months. And they got that by taking a real close look about what makes them unique, how can they create an experience that's really focused on what they're all about, which is creating the family tree for the world, and building around that, right? If they were just really looking to get something up and running and grab some code or some ideas from elsewhere, they might miss that opportunity. Another example is, Lindsay mentioned this a bit ago, is Dig. So on Dig, I hope my little movie plays here. My movie's not playing, but you all might be familiar with the inline voting on Dig. There's lots of different ways by which you could have somebody vote something up and down, right? So before we were looking at kind of the whole startup experience for a web application. Here we're looking at kind of a nuanced UI control. But Dig could have gone with one of these existing systems out there. They could have even grabbed some code or grabbed the UI from another site. But because they focused on this and made this one-click Dig activity really inline, really fast, Kevin Rose basically says in here, the activity when they did that went through the roof and it made all the difference in the world to their product. So if you're filching UI conventions or UI ideas out there, are you missing out on an opportunity like this? Another thing.
Anyone would suggest, you know, doing that for a startup or for a business, for something that one was counting on for as a business. I mean, if you're just putting together a weekend project that maybe you and five other people are going to see, it's kind of more important that you get the weekend project done than
yeah. I mean, that's
which
totally,
is not to say you shouldn't try to
that's
to,
totally fair. But I think we looked at some examples where those. I mean, is AOL a weekend project for you?
Well, no.
Just saying. Granted, when you're trying to get something going really quick, you might want to just grab a few things, but then you might also be missing the thing that makes your weekend project turn into the next Google, the next AOL, the next Facebook, or whatever, or the next Dig. So pros and cons. The last con I'll sort of point to is in terms of differentiation, right? Whose website is that? I mean, they all kind of, you know, same general color scheme, same general layout, same general structure and stuff. They all begin to blend together a little bit. So when you actually want to differentiate, have a clear brand message, or put something out into the world that when people see it and they recognize it as unique and differentiated, might not be a great idea to take and reuse some of the things that are already out there. So that's what I got on the user experience. We'll turn it over to Skip for a little bit, and then turn into a bit more of a discussion. You want mirror? Yep. Technical difficulties here.
Here we go. All right, so I want to start off with saying that I'm not a lawyer, and please don't use anything I say as legal advice, because I know just about as much as anybody who spent a couple of hours on the internet looking at copyright law. So I wanted to start off with just a general kind of overview of copyright and, you know, what's protected. And the Copyright Act uses the phrase work of authorship. to describe protection, or to describe what can be protected. And that's basically anything that's original, tangible, and a means of expression. And I think the really key thing for me was that means of expression was intentionally left vague to cover any kind of new technology that came out or new medium that could be delivered in. So it has to be something that you came up with. It needs to be fixed in some form. Otherwise, you can't copyright an idea. You can't copyright a concept, and it needs to be some form of creativity or expression, because you can't copyright a parts list, an inventory list. When is it protected? When it's been reduced to a tangible form. So the minute it's saved, the minute you hit save on your file, it's immediately protected by copyright law. What are the protections? To produce copies of the work and to sell them, create derivative works. If you create one piece of art, you can use that concept and create multiple pieces of art. To perform or display the work and to sell the rights to others. So do they apply to HTML and CSS? Because, we're talking mostly about web design here. The online opinion was relatively mixed that I saw. I didn't see any particular case or proof that HTML and CSS can be copyrighted, because HTML and CSS are a design language or a programming language, so they're not necessarily copyrightable. In the analogy that I saw that fit the best was, notes, notation, musical notation can't necessarily be copyrighted. You can't copyright a quarter note or an eighth note as a concept, but you can copyright a melody that uses those components in a greater piece. So I don't know. I feel pretty firmly that if you come up with a design and use of that, or that design's represented by a particular combination of CSS declarations and HTML markup, that's copyrightable. But that's just my opinion. Lindsay really wanted me to put this in here as a slide, because we were discussing the analogies between music and web design, and I was telling him about a anecdote that I heard about John Fogerty from Creedence Clearwater Revival. He was sued in 1985 by his former record label, Fantasy Records, because after he left Fantasy Records, he came out with a new album. And one of the songs was called Old Man Down the Road, which happened to sound a lot like Run Through the Jungle, which he recorded for Fantasy. And because Fantasy held full rights to those songs when he recorded them, they decided that he was guilty of plagiarizing himself, which is a pretty amusing thing to be accused of. Fantasy took him to court, and he ended up winning in district court, and eventually took it on to the Supreme Court to sue for legal fees, because it ended up costing him a ton of money. And the district court found that he was innocent of plagiarism, because the similarities in the song were similarities in the kind of base structure of the art form, right? Both songs used blues conventions. Both songs used similar singing style, similar kind of swamp rock imagery, and they basically found that that he couldn't necessarily be sued for using 1-4-5, chord structure. And I think in the terms of some of what Luke was showing, there are some conventions that are just part of the web design palette. Navigation bar on the left, header at the top, using an unordered list to represent links for a navigation bar. I don't know if anybody can necessarily copyright those constructs. And I thought it was a perfect analogy for you can't copyright web standards. You can't copyright semantic markup. But at the same time, if that semantic markup renders a design that looks exactly like another website's design, you could be guilty of plagiarizing that site, even though you're using markup that can't necessarily be copyrighted. So the next thing I want to talk about was open source software, and Lindsay mentioned that with the GPL.
Free software.
Yes, free software. Copyleft, as they say. The protections of open source software, or the what open source software licenses afford you, is the right to redistribute and derive from that software. So if a piece of JavaScript code is covered by an open source license, like the MIT license or the Apache license, then you're given certain permissions to copy that, make use of it in your work, make derivatives of that work, and then sell those derivatives in some licenses. The big differences between most of the open source licenses are whether they allow derivation and copies of that work to be freely given away, sold and made proprietary, or whether or not you need to add that license to the work that you create. So that's what I meant by it comes with strings attached. The GPL requires that when you make use of GPL licensed code, that you need to make any derivatives and any of the work that you create from that license code to be under the same GPL license. So if you're working on something that you intend to copyright, you want to be able to monetize and not make freely available, using the GPL is going to be a potentially a bad idea for you. There are other permissive licenses like the MIT license, the BSD license, that allow people to make use of that copyrighted software and then, or make use of code that's under that license and then, not allow open source permission. The open source licenses, most of the open source licenses that are used on the web that I've seen, and I'm primarily a DHTML coder, so I work mostly in JavaScript. Most of the open source software out there on web source code is on JavaScript. There isn't really a whole lot of open source licensing for HTML or for CSS that I've seen. Most of that is just covered under regular copyright law. So we're all sinners. I think as Lindsay mentioned earlier, everybody's done a little bit of copying from something they read online or on a blog. Everybody's made use of best practices or conventions out there, using an unordered list for a navbar, trying to use a three column layout by floating some of the columns. Those aren't necessarily perfect examples of filching, but I think everybody's done a little. I've lost my presenter notes. View source, it was a really great thing for me. Being able to just check out other, being able to check out the how things were done and learn from those, learn from that source code is a, I think it really fueled the innovation and the progress of the web. And, the fact that people are putting their code out there on blogs and putting forward the concept of best practices like that are, that definitely fuels an environment of sharing. And it's definitely something that should be, there should be an acceptance of. So when does it cross the line? I guess that's really what we're here about. If one copies the markup of a website, goes and you know, say I want to use Lindsay's example of Dig for a website, and I go in and I copy Dig's source code and I replace it with my own content and throw away the CSS file and the images, put my own images in, move things around, relatively make it a brand new looking site. Is that infringement? You know, CSS in Garden was a fantastic example of, you know, how you can take the exact same source code that, you know, doesn't have full copyright protection because, you know, it's just a markup language, and apply a completely different CSS file, completely different images, and come up with what looks like a fundamentally different website. You know, and I guess to follow the theme, you know, is this filching? Is this fair? You know, these two websites, fairly clearly are...
Maybe content's filch.
Yeah, yeah. Given if one weren't to consider the content, the words itself, the design is a completely unique design. If you modify another author's work, when does it... I think this is something that I found to be the most interesting kind of sort of gray area as far as when something's ethically acceptable and when it's not. I mean, this kind of goes into the notion of sketching. I think the imagery that I found the most applicable is, you know, shaping a piece of clay. You know, you take a concept or markup or a JavaScript code that you found online, and you slowly take it from the what would be outright plagiarism if you just took it and claimed it as your own or put it in your own code without giving any attribution. And you know, I'm going to change this here, move this over there, change this color. At what point does it cease to be a derivative infringement, and when does it become a brand new piece of work? So I thought I'd kind of do a live or an example here of that. And so I'll start with my Delicious page on Delicious Talk, or the Delicious link sharing website. And I'll go in and make a website devoted to haikus. Because, I like haikus. They're short, they're simple. And so I'll make a haiku sharing site. And here's my haikus. I came up with them about 2 in the morning, so they might be a little strange. And, you know, this is obviously Delicious's design. I changed, changed nothing. I'd be accused of infringement just from the image, using someone else's image file. But what if I change it around a little bit? Here, I'll put some hideous green background color and change the links to a different color. You know, hey, right? It's different, right? Yeah? Filch, fair. What do you think? It's filch. I mean, it's I changed like one hex code for the color, and no, two hex codes is the only difference. Well, and I took out the Delicious logo. So it's pretty much robbery. So, okay, well, I'll change around a little bit. I'll get rid of the borders, and I'll move the I'll kind of remove some of the cruft for the login stuff, and add a little padding around the items. So is this now a fair piece of work, or is it what do you think? Filter fair? Yeah.
Now, if you saw this in the wild, would you ever know? Like, let's say you met Skip and you were working with him and he showed you his haiku site. Do you think you'd pick out the Delicious reference at all? Okay.
So I'll change around a little bit more, right? Got a little Web 2.0 logo going up there in the corner, and
nice.
I moved the tags over to the left, and I got rid of some of the stuff in the bottom. What else did I do? Oh, I changed the how many per page to a select box, because that's super usable, right? What else did I do? I think that's about it. So is it now becoming a new piece of work, or is it still infringement? Is it? I'm hearing mixed.
They're saying fairch.
Yeah, I'm hearing a mixed crowd. It's starting to become a little more unique.
Which, that's a filch of the English language, by the way.
Yeah,
fairch.
Fairch. So, all right, so I think the next one was, here we go. I'm like, all right, the green's hideous. I'll change it to something else. I moved the nav to the right, and I beefed up that chunky logo a little bit more. And I cleaned up the pagination. I dropped the stuff at the top and changed the words to previous and next.
So, Skip, I'm going to ask a question here. So far, your five iterations have been all sort of visual changes, but what we didn't talk about the original thing of taking a tagging and saving site structure and architecture and applying it to haikus. I mean, that seems to be the thing that all this is that something that could be copyright infringement or legal? Right, but I'm talking about the concept of it. Like, so we're talking about like layout and design here. The whole point that people can save, share, tag, there's a structure around these things, that whole larger organizational thing.
Is YouTube a derivative of Delicious at that point?
I don't know. No, so probably not, but
folksonomies and having a social network where you can see your friends' content. I mean,
well, just the whole general idea of I mean, if you're finding haikus, saving them, tagging them, you've got an idea. I mean,
the thing is when I
why start with Delicious?
When
I guess
I got
is my
to,
question.
Definitely. I don't want to defend stealing someone's idea and applying it to a different domain. I kind of picked this because it was an easy example. I actually picked it primarily because the design was so simple that it wouldn't be too hard to change it around for use of example. But it could have been anyone. I definitely don't want to defend that as a practice. I don't think that I would use that. In all the cases that I've done, like borrowing of content like that, it's been borrowing more IA concepts. So, you know, it's I made a social networking site for activists to meet up and share information. And I wanted to create it kind of open-ended sort of thing where anybody could create a group and join the group and add content to that group. And so I went and looked at Flickr, and I was like, well, I love the way Flickr's group system works. I didn't necessarily go in and copy code, copy visual design, but I copied the concept of creating a group and adding content to that group.
And I think the interesting thing about this is somebody that spends an awful lot of time making background patterns might look at this and be like, hey, somebody ripped off my background pattern.
It's from Squidfingers.
Right? Whereas somebody else, I'm just trying to point out the different levels of design nuance. The person who spends all their time doing visual design might be tuned in to a very particular type of filching, whereas they wouldn't think twice about grabbing a whole bunch of HTML code because they don't do HTML, so they don't understand that somebody blood, sweat, and teared into it, right? So I'm going to spend all my time doing these little pixels, and if somebody uses it, it's stealing. We've got Jared in the back with a question.
Part of the problem here is that you're confusing different types of intellectual property. There's copyright. There's also trademark and trade dress, which protects the look. The test behind trademark and trade dress is confusing similarities. And then there's patent, which is the methodology, such as the one-click dig button. And they are actually very different types of intellectual property. The reason I happen to know this is I've been serving for the last few years as expert witnesses, so I've actually had the opportunity to hear lawyers argue about this distinction in front of judges for hours on end. And what you've been talking about here, this changing of the look, that's trade dress modification. And if it could be confused for something else, the AOL Yahoo look, that people go to court over that, and they drag me in as an expert witness over it. So I've sat there and heard those arguments. The copyright comes to the underlying code, the expression part of this. So you'd have to look at the markup to see if there's a copyright violation. But you could have a completely different markup to generate completely similar designs. So you've got to separate these things out if you really want to talk about the distinctions, because they're really important.
Yeah, well, I think the point I was making was based on what you spend your time doing, you may see one or two of those. You may not see one or two of those levels, right? So you might not see the patent on the interactive dig click. You may just see, oh, I'll grab the code that does this little UI widget. Or if you're not somebody that spends a lot of time doing information architecture and thinking about what's on the page, you might say, oh, I'll just kind of use this overall layout that these people have on the page. Versus if you're just a designer, you might say, oh, I'm just going to grab some HTML code, which might be copyrighted. And then you might have issues there, right?
Well, that's something we wondered, too, is okay, how many of you guys consider yourselves designers? So would you be more comfortable stealing code or design? Code, right? Surely, because it's not your expert thing. Whereas I, like, you know, I'm a coder. I'm not going to, you know, I might think, you know, I design, I'll make it work, right? It, I think it does speak to that.
So let's ask the inverse. How many people are coders? How many of you would steal design? Okay. So I think that speaks to, you know, I think that speaks to that difference I was trying to make was it's your sensitivity to what's okay and what's not okay depends on what you do all day long, right? Yep.
Just make it simple, but I mean, just give credit. I mean, I fill my designs all the time, but I write to people and I put the credit there. Yeah. Sure.
So do you actually contact, he's saying he filters design all the time, but he gives credit. So you contact people, say, is this okay? And if they say no?
Yeah.
Well, actually, I would let me put that out to you guys. Do you know when you're doing it? I mean, so let me just give you a simple example. When back in the day when doing rollovers on buttons was cool, how many people went and just grabbed a little JavaScript code that allowed you to do the rollovers? Few people? Did you feel you were filching? No. Okay. So were you? I don't know. Sometimes you know. Sometimes you don't. Yeah. So those that couldn't hear, he basically made the opposite point, which is if there's a skill you don't know how to do, you're more likely to be more sensitive to stealing it because it's not something you can do, whereas if you know how to do it, you might just grab something that somebody else did to save yourself time because you know what you're getting into.
Other?
Yeah, and I would actually love to see a visualization of some code and how it's moved through the web, right? Like, I mean, I go back to that rollover button example because I think everybody at some point was like, ooh, rollover, how do I do that, right? And just drop it in there.
Well, is it substantial though? I mean, that turned out to be the you know, like the line. Is it substantial? Is it really a significant two lines of JavaScript code?
What if those two lines of JavaScript code power something that's patentable, like Jared was talking about? Like, let's say Dig patented that one-click digging, and it's only two lines of JavaScript code to make that.
Yeah,
does that become substantial then? I mean.
We share in a source control tree, and that's, you know, highly encouraged that you use things in the source control tree. In fact, it's deemed you're considered a less well-versed engineer if you come and you rewrite something that's already in the tree. If you send that for code review, you will get shamed for, well, it's in, you know, blah, 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 blah. It's in there. Don't rewrite it.
Yeah, but how do you handle open source software or software that is borrowed from other.
Oh, is that?
Because we have a fairly strict review process for using any open source software. One, it has to be identified from the start that you're using open source. You can't just put something in there and then, oh, yeah, that's it's okay, it's open source. So it has to be identified, it has to go through a review process with legal, and I wouldn't say it's discouraged, but everyone definitely knows the amount of work that has to be done to vet it firsthand.
Yeah, one.
And one of the things that came up when I was discussing this with some coworkers was that, I think Lindsay mentioned it earlier, but work for hire and work that you do as a contractor, I need to solve this problem. I'm going to copy a couple of lines of JavaScript code, refactor it a little bit so that it's original now and submit it to my client. You're putting your client at risk. And then if you also make use of code that you gave to your client as work for hire, which is technically owned by your client, you're put yourself at risk for infringing against yourself.
Has anybody gotten into legal trouble for filching anything online? Okay, so I think that's also a very important thing, that there's really no consequence right now to a lot of this stuff, at least no visible consequence. Right?
It's reputation.
Yeah. So actually, look, you can ask this to everybody. To what extent do strong notices in CSS or JavaScript affect your behavior of filching or not? Do they? Yeah?
Yeah.
Jared, I think we're running low on time, so we got, yeah.
Your question about people getting in trouble.
Yeah.
Right now, it's really, really expensive to prosecute and take someone to court over this. So all these big boys are sort of doing it with each other. You're not going to see it happening with smaller organizations just because they're just not going to go that route. They'll just hit you with all sorts of other sort of legal power and just get you to defend because you're going to spend $500,000 trying to defend your protection.
It's also interesting that a lot of patents are used defensively instead of offensively, meaning a company will just sort of stack up a patent portfolio in case they get sued by somebody for patent infringement. And then it can be like, well, we have these patents. And if we have these patents, and it's sort of like standoffish. Peter, some questions? Yeah.
I think it's a bad thing. I think that it's, one of the funny things that happened is I made the Google Korea homepage, and originally they were going to do this bar at the bottom in Flash where all the text would be vectors, it would all be impossible to copy. And one of the great things that happened at the site, and now it's in JavaScript and text, so people copied it and redid the site in, Chinese. They redid it in, Portuguese. There's a couple, kind of fanboyish sites because it's really cool. The animations roll over. You couldn't have done that if they had put it up in Flash. And I mean, that's what you want. I mean, you want people to be able to use this stuff, make it universal. And so I'm not into. That's one of the reasons why I stopped, programming in Flash. Is I just got, it just kind of grated me.
There may be a dark side to that if the UI you made was very not usable or something like that, right?
I mean,
and that starts proliferating around the web, which I do think there are bad conventions and bad code that have made their way all across the web, and it results in a lot of very bad and broken experiences. But because stealing it or copying it was easier and faster than creating a better workaround, those kind of bad solutions get all over the place. Perfect example to me is the sign-up form. I think the sign-up form is one of the stupidest things in but it's so easy to say, you are a record in a database, here are the form fields you need to fill out to become this, it's just easy to do that, and it's proliferated everywhere, but it's a terrible user experience, and it doesn't really accomplish the goals that...
Skip. But at the same time, though, the ability to do view source and to learn from cool things that you've seen, spreads knowledge around, incredibly fast. I think that's the trade-offs that you get, the bad things that come of that are don't equal the benefit.
All right, we got to go because we're a little over time. Thank you all for coming.